Today on the Root Cause Medicine Podcast.
So the chemicals themselves are FDA approved, and they come, you know, the regulation states it has to come from an FDA registered facility. So every ingredient that a compounding pharmacy is compounding with does come from an FDA approved facility. The final product is not a product that we're going to market to the masses. That's where FDA comes in and says, oh, this dosage form, this strength, you know, they do all of the testing and it's good for everyone. But what we do as a compounding pharmacy is we like really individualize it just to you. So we're not saying that what we're making is going to be good for everyone. That working with the doctor and the patient and the pharmacy, you really customize that individual dose. So I like to say it's a one-person clinical trial. So you're the one person that you're going to measure the outcome. The doctor's going to measure levels. And then we're going to, you know, adjust dosing based on that individual patient versus saying this is good for hundreds of thousands of people.
Hello, hello. I'm your co-host for today, Dr. Carrie Jones. And I am so excited to bring on pharmacist Sarah Hover from PCCA. And we are going to talk about all things compounding. Now, oddly, there's some intrigue around compounding pharmacies. So I asked her all the questions. The thing about a compounding pharmacy is that it can be really helpful when you're trying to make a medication for a group that maybe can't do traditional medications. For example, the way your child might need something. A tablet may not work for them. Maybe your dog or cat needs something, your horse. Maybe you need a specific dose that isn't available at a conventional pharmacist. Maybe you have allergies to an ingredient, a dye, an adhesive, an oil, and you can't do what's traditionally out there, so you have to have it compounded. I asked her about FDA approval and the studies behind compounding pharmacies. And then, of course, I asked her about the options. We talked about hormones. We talked about pain creams. We talked about acne creams. We talked about hair loss options and a whole lot more. So if you're curious about compounding pharmacies, but maybe you've seen some interesting things out there on social media, or you know that the medication that you have or have tried before wasn't quite right, you had an allergy or a reaction, and you just know if that dose could be a little different or made without that oil or without that adhesive, it would work even better, then this is the episode for you. Before we get started though, I want to talk to you about something that comes up pretty often on this podcast. And that of course is lab testing. You see, testing is one essential way to understand the root cause of an illness. If you are an integrative or functional medicine practitioner, chances are you're placing a ton of orders with a ton of different labs. The Root Cause Medicine Podcast is created by Rupa Health. Rupa is the best way to order, manage, and track results from over 30 different labs in one single place for free. Thank goodness. No need to create and log into multiple portals ever again. If you are a practitioner, make sure you go sign up at rupahealth.com to create a free account today. Now, let's start the show. Sarah Hover, welcome to the Root Cause Medicine Podcast. Having a compounding pharmacist on has been a top tier number one of mine because so many people have questions around compounding in general. What is a compounding pharmacist? What can you do with compounding pharmacies? And oddly enough, it's really controversial on social media right now. So welcome to the podcast. I'm going to ask you all the questions.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Dr. Jones. I always love being in your presence. I always learn from you as well. So this will be fun.
Well, to get us started, actually, what's your background in pharmacy? So we can sort of set that foundation. And then I'm going to get into like, what's the difference between Walgreens, a compounding pharmacy, or Kroger and a compounding pharmacy? And then we'll move from there.
Yeah, absolutely. I have been a pharmacist for 30 years, but I thought I was going to work in the hospital. And then I ended up getting a summer job for a compounding only pharmacy in Dallas. And I just fell in love. Yeah, there was this pharmacist that was, you know, in his later 50s, early 60s, excited to be there every day. And he gave me new and challenging things. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is what I want to do. And I remember calling my dad about halfway through summer. And I'm like, Daddy, this is it. This is what I want to do. And he's like, I could have told you that after the first week. You were so excited about all the things you were doing. Just because you were really meeting patient needs and it was not boring. It wasn't the same thing. You weren't just counting by fives. You weren't saying the same thing, take one three times a day till they're all gone. It was always something new and different. And I think that's what I really, really love about being a compounding pharmacist. But it's been a journey. I've learned a lot over the years and things are constantly changing and constantly learning, which is great. My specialty is hormone replacement, but what I was saying 5 years ago is not necessarily what I'm saying today because we've learned new things.
which is really cool. And I've been using compounding pharmacies since, let's see here, I went to medical school in 2001. My mentor, I started working with in 2002. And I am in the Portland, Oregon area. We have amazing compounding pharmacies out here. And at the time when compounding pharmacies weren't as popular, they were critical, key for my education. People ask me all the time, where did you learn about hormones? So, well, my mentor and then all the compounding pharmacists around here were just so generous. And they still are to this day. But back then, that's who I turned to for help and suggestions and ideas. So that's my next question. What is a compounding pharmacy? And how is that different than a typical pharmacy people might go get their medication or antibiotic prescribed at or filled at?
Yeah, absolutely. So compounding pharmacy is kind of where pharmacy began. Back before there were all the manufactured products, your pharmacist actually took the different chemicals and made creams, gels, capsules, just whatever specifically that you needed to treat your condition. And so it's kind of going back to our roots of this is where pharmacy actually started. I had a compounding only pharmacy and my kids actually came to the pharmacy when they were little. And my oldest not that long ago had to get a regular prescription filled. And she's like, Mom, why is it taking them so long? All they have to do is count the pills and put it in a bottle. Okay. You had to make it. And I was like, okay, those folks work really, really hard. They've got a lot of things thrown at them. Please be kind to your pharmacist at the traditional pharmacies because they're dealing with a lot of other things as well. But compounding is just more individualized. Like if someone has an allergy to, say, a red dye and the medication only comes in a red dyed capsule, if as long as we can get the raw ingredient, the chemical, then we could compound that into a dosage form that is appropriate for the patient or children. So sometimes children need adult medications that only come in tablets. You can't get the right dose. You can't get it in them. And then same thing for a veterinary pharmacy. You know, you have our furry friends need medication and sometimes it's not available. Or based on their species, the commercial product maybe has an ingredient in there that's toxic to, say, a dog. And so you would need to be able to get the raw chemical to make that specifically for them. So it is a very niche market. I think out of all prescriptions that are filled, only 3-5% are needed to be compounded. But when you're on that 3-5% boat, you're very appreciative when you find someone that can specialize something for you.
And is the training for a compounding pharmacy different? Do you go to different pharmacy schools? Do you have different pharmacy degrees? Or do you start out the same and then move on into compounding?
Yeah, so most schools of pharmacy do offer some sort of compounding training. Now, I had already worked in a big compounding pharmacy before I went to pharmacy school. And so when we were making capsules one by hand, one at a time, the whole time I was like, this is not how it's done. We have a big machine where we make, 100 at a time. So depending on the school that you go to, you can have a different experience. You can go to extra training after pharmacy school or before. So there's different, like ECCA that I work for, we offer different training. We have student training. We have pharmacist training. So the biggest thing is having the right tools and knowing what you can do and knowing how to do things. So most people need extra training after pharmacy school, unless you're at a school that really, really, really focuses on that.
And then once you are a compounding pharmacy, I see this a lot on social media, so I'm going to just bring it right up. We hear a lot about, FDA approved, or it's not pharmaceutical versus compounding. Like, you should always stick with pharmaceutical. You should always stick with FDA approved. What does that mean? And then how does that translate to a pharmacist filling something at compounding pharmacy?
Yeah, absolutely. So the chemicals themselves are FDA approved, and they come, the regulation state, it has to come from an FDA registered facility. So every ingredient that a compounding pharmacy is compounding with does come from an FDA approved facility. The final product is not a product that we're going to market to the masses. That's where FDA comes in and says, this dosage form, this strength, they do all of the testing and it's good for everyone. But what we do as a compounding pharmacy is we really individualize it just to you. So we're not saying that what we're making is going to be good for everyone. That working with the doctor and the patient and the pharmacy, you really customize that individual dose. So I like to say it's a one-person clinical trial. So you're the one person that you're going to measure the outcome. The doctor's going to measure levels. And then we're going to, adjust dosing based on that individual patient versus saying this is good for hundreds of thousands of people.
And then what steps are put into place to guarantee, if something is compounded, it's custom, obviously. So how do we know that the compounding pharmacist who makes it up, at the end, that's what it is?
So you definitely want to vet your compounding pharmacy, and especially if you're a prescriber and even a patient. Go in, go ask to look at their facility. People that are doing things right are proud to show off their facility and show you how they do things. You can ask for testing. What sort of testing are they doing on their final products? And especially if you're looking at like what's called a narrow therapeutic index drug. So something that it's, you know, not enough of it doesn't work, too much of it is bad. You have this tiny window where it's perfect. If it's a drug like that, you definitely want to make sure that they're testing. And I would ask to see their results because it's too important to make sure you get something right. Thyroid is one of those that's super important too, especially if you're doing T4 or T3 specifically. You want to see what their testing is because you're talking about microgram doses. It's tiny amounts. They really need to make sure that they're testing to get that correct. Ask, what sort of education are you going through? You know, like I said, things are constantly changing. So, you know, you can't just be stuck in what I was doing in the 90s. You need to be up to date. So are you constantly training? What does your staff training look like? What kind of education events do you go to? You know what organizations they're affiliated with so that you know that they are staying on top of things. So really vetting that pharmacy is crucial. I had a patient one time, this was years ago. She wanted to see my pharmacy license. And I was like, okay, it's right here on the wall. But she wanted to make sure I was really a pharmacist. And so, you know, I think asking those questions is critical. I think we as patients have to really take control of our healthcare, and asking those questions of our providers and of our pharmacist is important.
And actually, you alluded to this earlier, but why are there not studies on compounded medications? Because you had said earlier, like, well, it's kind of an N of one versus an N of hundreds of thousands. You get the same amoxicillin. It is what it is. Why is it hard to do studies on compounded stuff?
Unfortunately, it just comes down to money. You know, it's just so expensive to run those big trials. And especially if it's double blind, placebo controlled, it's millions of dollars to do those sort of things. And so you will find some small studies. Sometimes we have to kind of glean information from multiple small studies. Okay, this one had 10 patients. Okay, this is the response. This one had 15, and, you know, it's not going to be the huge, large scale that we see. And a lot of times that's, you know, people look at that as a negative of, oh, well, there's not the studies. But when you start looking at that doctor working directly with that patient and really fine tuning it, you know, you as a practitioner, you're not going to, oh, you're doing terrible, I'm going to keep doing what you're doing. No, you're going to solve that problem and figure that out. So looking at small trials can be helpful, but then that individual patient is really, really key.
No, you said this earlier too, like some of the reasons somebody might choose compounding pharmacies, but I want to dig into that more because I think that's what really piques people's interest. First, I want to ask you, like, what are the top most common things that you see compounded? And then what are some fun things that you do that you see compounded?
Well, I mean, I mentioned earlier, hormones are kind of my jam. That's where I spend most of my day. But so bioidentical hormone replacement therapy is probably one of the biggest parts of our compounding pharmacist business, just because we can really individualize that therapy for patients. And it's rewarding. I remember this was my big aha moment when I was working in the pharmacy after pharmacy school. I was a pharmacist. Patient came in and she was like, I was on compounded hormones and my provider changed. So my husband said I needed to go to someone that was in network. And all of a sudden he put me on something else. And now I have trouble sleeping and my blood pressure is elevated. I'm on something for anxiety and depression. And I wasn't on any of those things when I was on compounded. And that was just so I told my husband, I don't care. I'm paying for this doctor because I want this therapy. And that was my big, oh, wow. Like we really are making impact in patients' lives. Between that and the nutrition that she was getting from coming into the pharmacy, you know, the extra magnesium, the things to help her sleep, you know, all those things were coupled together with her hormones that it just a huge difference. So that was my big aha, and I love it. I feel like a lot of ladies are told that they're crazy. They're told to go see their psychiatrist when really it's about their nutrition, their gut, and their hormones and working on all of that. So just really trying to fine tune that for patients is really one of the biggest things I think that we work with. Something fun, kind of going along the same lines, is things, you know, sexual health. I worked with one of my providers to formulate this is back when they were coming up with all these screen cream, dream cream. I wanted it to be a little more clinical than that. But I was like, you know, they've been using this one medication in erectile dysfunction for many years, papaverin, the same tissue when we differentiate to be boy or girl. What if we did something topical or even try to drive it in a little bit with a little transdermal, the female clitoris, and then that would improve blood flow to the area. And it made such a difference in my patients' lives. So just that vasodilation right to the area is kind of fun. And I enjoy talking about it. Sometimes people, you can see people get a little uncomfortable, but I love that because I mean, it's our body and you know, that what makes the world go around. So that's something fun.
Well, and especially because there aren't any options. I mean, I think if anyone's spent any amount of time, again, like sticking with the hormone world, in hormone world or social media, especially for women, there's no FDA approved testosterone. And so you either have to use the male version at a very small dose, or you have to go get it compounded because it's just straight up not available yet. And that's unfortunate. And the same goes to anything with sexual health. I mean, there's very little available for women when it comes to sexual health and numbness or lack of blood flow, or, you know, due to a variety of reasons, is a huge concern, especially as women get older and their hormones change. And to have a compounded option could really change their whole outlook on life and improve relationships and how they feel about themselves. Like I said, I've always been very partial to compounding pharmacies for this reason, but I don't think this information is out there. It's like, oh, right now it's like, oh, we have nothing FDA approved. Sorry. They're like, oh, we have no options. I'm sorry. And it's like, well, actually, we do have options.
And the FDA approved product for men for testosterone, I really can't wrap my head around how a female patient accurately uses an appropriate dose. I've seen the recommendations for that, and I just literally cannot wrap my head around how you can be accurate with getting the appropriate dose. And the last thing you want is to get too much testosterone. So right. You want to do physiological levels of all of these. So
actually, okay, let's talk about routes too. Because with compounding pharmacies, you can do a variety of things. You can do like pills and lozenges and creams, and they can be dosed specifically. You have lots of options when it comes to route of administration, but then the way you administer it as well. So it is dosed appropriately, meaning like two clicks and that's what you need, or, you know, two lines and that's what you need if it's something transdermal. Or let's say a lozenge, right? Like it's in the lozenge, you take the lozenge and right. That's it.
Yeah, that's what's fun too. It's fun with unique dosage forms and coming up with unique ways to meet that patient need, because, you know, I can tell a patient like all the great things they need to do, but if it's not going to be in a way that they can really utilize it, or they're not going to utilize it, then, you know, it doesn't matter what you or I say to a patient, because we need to make sure it's something that they can use, you know, easily. So sometimes people have trouble with dexterity. So, you know, working with a syringe, they might not be able to do that. So like you said, the clickers or the topic clicks make it easier for patients to use. Some people are worried about transference. If they've applied mm-hmm. something topically, is it going to get to their animals or their children or grandchildren? So maybe they need to do something transvaginal, or maybe they need to do something sublingual. That's what's always fun too. I had a pediatric patient. I had gone and talked to this pediatrician's office. And of course, I was selling them that I can solve your problems, like send your problems to me. And so they did. They sent me a problem. This poor little two-year-old had drank after his mom, who had a cold sore. And, you know, the first outbreak of herpes virus is the worst. And he was all the way down his esophagus. He had lesions, and he wouldn't take the medication. He wouldn't take the antiviral. And so they called me, and I was like, oh, no problem. I got this. And so I called. I had all these great ideas. And then I called mom, and everything that I suggested, she was like, you won't do that. Nope, he won't do that. I got to fix this kid, because I mean, I have to fix the kid, but then also have to fix the kid because I told this physician that I could fix the kid. And so I ended up coming up with some little popsicles. So the dose was in each little popsicle. She froze it so the cold felt good. And he like would beg for his next dose and got it all cleared up. And so that was one of my big aha moments of, I might have all these great ideas, but it's not necessarily going to work for that patient if I don't have that conversation. And especially when we're talking about an animal or a child, the caregiver always knows best. They know what flavors they like. They know what dosage form is going to work. And we just have to listen. But being able to be creative and think outside the box, we were able to solve the problem. So that's a fun story.
I love that story. And actually, it makes me think of this past weekend, I was with some friends and one was using an estrogen patch. And I could tell, because she moves her estrogen patch, there was irritation on the skin. And I said, do you think you're allergic to the adhesive on the estrogen patch? And she was like, oh yeah, definitely. I have very sensitive skin, a lot of histamine reactions. I'm absolutely reactive. And I was like, you don't have to stick with the patch. You may love the particular dose, but there are other ways that we can just completely bypass adhesives. How often do you see people who come in for compounding because of red dye allergies, peanut allergies, adhesive allergies, and they're so frustrated and stuck?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that allergy to the adhesive is super, super common. Now, my view is going to be a little skewed because the ones that do great, I don't see them, but I only see the problem ones. But I also had another patch patient. Maybe you've heard me say this from stage, but she was a semi-pro golfer. I live in the Dallas area, and we've ever been to Dallas in the August, September. It's hotter than Hades. And so she was a semi-pro golfer, you know, on the golf course, you know, 100 degrees outside. And she came to see me and she's like, I feel like I put that patch on and then it's gone. I started thinking about physics and heat transfer. And I'm like, I bet you are absolutely right that that heat sped up that absorption. So she like sucked everything out of the patch in the first day, day and a half, and then had nothing until it was time to change her patch. I don't know that they really tested that, you know, when they were testing the patches. So anyone that's super active outdoors or has sensitive skin, I just don't think they're a candidate for a patch. It's another thing to think about.
Which is good. Now, you also mentioned thyroid, compounding thyroid medication. Let's talk about that because thyroid medication is so commonly prescribed when we think of like T4 or T3 or some sort of combination. But to get it custom made for you, I don't think crosses a lot of people's minds.
Yeah. So there are, you know, some people just need a varied concentration of each one. It's not an exact amount. Not everyone fits into the mold of what's available commercially. Some people like to combine them to where they're just, you know, only doing one versus having to swallow multiple things. It's very tedious. You know, thyroid, as you know, is very, very particular. And we have to make sure we're also addressing the adrenals when we're working with a thyroid. And I think that gets overlooked by some regular practitioners. They just, you know, just say, oh, here's your thyroid numbers are low. And they never stop and look at the adrenals. My colleague, Rennell, pointed out that in the package insert for thyroid, it says a contraindication is I'm having issues with the adrenals. So if you're on thyroid, make sure someone is also looking at your adrenals. But yeah, it can definitely be compounded into specific doses. There for a while, there were some of the porcine thyroid manufacturers had issues. And so we would compound, you know, porcine thyroid because the plant blew up and no way you could get a 30 milligram or a 60 milligram. And so we were constantly, you know, you don't want to change someone's thyroid dose. It's almost like you don't wake a sleeping baby. You don't change someone's thyroid dose or their hormones. Like if it's balanced, you stay put because that's the last thing we want to rock the boat. So, you know, there are instances where something needs to be compounded because it's not available or the patient needs something individual. So tricky that you need to make sure you're using the right person if you're having it compounded.
And when you're looking at conventional, traditional thyroid doses, they also have binder and filler and colors, other added stuff that some people may be sensitive to and not even realize it because they don't always disclose that. You have to like really go through your insert.
Right. And I read an article about how one manufacturer just changed one of the excipients in the tablet. And then they followed these patients and all of their TSHs just like skyrocketed. Mm-hmm. And it was literally because of the excipient that was in the tablet affect the absorption. So because they changed it to lactose and people just didn't absorb their thyroid the same way. So that's also super critical too. If anyone ever changes the manufacturer, you know, even if you're getting it regularly from the regular pharmacy and manufacturer changes, I would get in to have more labs drawn because things can change. And since thyroid runs so many things in our body, it's important that it's optimal.
And I don't think people also realize in medications that they are allowed to have a little window of variance. So if you are getting something, let's say that's 100 milligrams, that's what you've been prescribed. Take 100 milligrams of this thing. The FDA allows a little bit on either side. So some days you may get 90 or 85, and some days you may get 105, 110. But again, with thyroid, you don't want to run that risk.
It's plus or minus 10% is what's allowed. That's what gets tricky when someone, there's some thought out there that you should always start with a commercial product if you're going to compound it versus the bulk chemical. Well, if I'm already starting with something that's 90%, how accurate can I be with, you know, the finished product? So we always want people to use the bulk chemical when at all possible. Sometimes it's not available. But yeah, because of that variance, it's tricky to compound from the commercial product.
What's interesting is years ago, I was consulting with a primary care doctor about hormones, progesterone, et cetera. And he said, gosh, every time I recommend, in this particularly hard case, every time this person uses Prometrium, which is a progesterone capsule, they kind of break out in this rash and their lips kind of swell. And I said, are they allergic to peanuts by chance? And they were like, oh yeah, they're, you know, pretty sensitive to peanuts. I said, you know, peanut oil is what it's hanging out in. Like that's the oil that's in Prometrium, the progesterone capsule. You might want to have it compounded. And that was it. That was the switch. Like this primary care didn't know. They hadn't read the insert to realize. Again, years ago, it's a lot more common knowledge now, but didn't realize peanut oil was in there. And actually a lot of people don't, or maybe you don't have a full-blown like anaphylactic peanut reaction, but it's mild enough that in your daily home, you just don't eat peanuts. So you forget to tell your OBGYN or whoever's going to prescribe a hormone for you. And all of a sudden you're giving this Prometrium peanut oil and like, poof, you get these weird reactions. Get figured out.
And some people think that, oh, I consume something and I have a reaction. But, you know, you and I know that it's going to be 3-4 days later that you actually react to it. So, and some people just have, like you said, not a full blown, you know, the lips swell, stop breathing, but they could just not feel good, you know? And a lot of times it is the excipient. And so I had a lot of patients that were had all sorts of chemical sensitivity. And so we had to like be super, super clean with everything we compounded for them because just the excipient would kind of wreck their world. So some people don't realize that just, you know, the lactose in a product or the peanut oil, if that's what's making them feel bad, the medicine gets the blame for it. And they think, Oh, I can't take that medicine because I feel bad when I take it, when it really was the excipients that were in there that caused the problem, or the extra ingredients.
I was going to say, if you can define excipient, but yeah, those extra ingredients. Yeah, most definitely. Right.
Yeah.
No, I want to talk about other topical things, like topical things for eczema, topical for psoriasis or acne. How popular or common are those?
Yeah, super common. You know, again, sometimes we can do a combination of different ingredients that's not, you know, not commercially available. Sometimes there are ingredients that are only available like in an eye drop, but it's a great anti-allergy. So it can be used great topically for eczema or psoriasis. Ketotifen is what comes to mind with that. I've recommended that for people's scars, kind of prevent scars from getting too gnarly, and also helping with itching, you know, different anti-aging combinations. You know, when I worked with a lot of perimenopausal, menopausal ladies, I mean, that's the other thing we're worried about. Like, you know, we want to feel good, but we also want to look good too. And, you know, so making some different combinations that can help with pain, their collagen, and help with wrinkles is super popular. Hair loss. Oh my gosh. Hair loss is a big, big market, you know. We want to feel good, we want to look good, and we want all of our hair. So, you know, some different combinations of that can be very, very beneficial for men and women.
When it comes to the anti-aging part of it, I do want to ask this. So obviously right now there are compounding pharmacies, but also other companies that are making a little tiny bit of estradiol, let's say, in a facial cream. And I'm seeing pushback. I see people who are like, you shouldn't apply estradiol to your skin, even though you can, like to your face, even though you can apply it to the rest of your body, into your vagina, et cetera. Whereas others are like, no, it's life-changing. It's helping my collagen. And again, it's a very, very, very tiny dose. What do you say? How do you answer when women say to you, I'm a little nervous, I'll put estrogens on my face as part of a preserve my skin type of therapy?
I am definitely for it as long as it's prescribed and it's compounded for you. I get really nervous when I see these other products out there that have estrogen in them and you're not being monitored. You can absorb it through your skin. And if you look at, you know, a saliva test, now you might see it more there when you've applied it to your skin. But as far as a therapy, it's fabulous for helping to maintain the skin. I mean, estrogen brings moisture. And you think about as we go through perimenopause, menopause, everything is dry. Eyes are dry, skin is dry. And so estrogen brings that moisture, which can help with the vitality of your skin. So that's super helpful. But I don't like when I see it just out there as a product anyone can use, because I think there should be some monitoring.
And actually, speaking of products out there, I get the question a lot on the over-the-counter wild yam cream and how some people feel the wild yam cream will automatically turn into progesterone in the body. Will you address that?
Happy to, yes. And that's been a topic for many, many, many years. So there's no guarantee, like your body is going to turn it into the hormone that you need. Yam and soy are sources of all of our hormones. And if you look at our raw chemicals that we have at PCCA, they either come from soy or from yam, you know, so it can be extracted from those plant sources. But that doesn't mean that if we rub it on our skin, that the body is going to convert that to the specific hormone. Going back a little bit to you were saying about women being afraid of estrogen, I don't think we've done women in our country justice when it comes to hormones and understanding that estradiol specifically is anti-inflammatory. If we don't do anything, and that's what I would tell my patients, doing nothing doesn't mean you're safe. We don't do anything, we're going to put on more adipose tissue, more fat tissue, which is going to make estrone, which is pro-inflammatory, is going to cause inflammation. We're going to be in a not good situation where our body needs the estrogen and you want that estradiol as anti-inflammatory. If estrogen really was a cause of breast cancer, our 20 and 21-year-olds would be rampant with breast cancer because their levels are through the roof. So I think it's just replacing what our body was making before, similar proportion, and creating that balance that's important. So.
Most definitely. I do want to go back to the hair loss because I know people are going to immediately perk up with that. Not that you're giving out specifics, but what are common ingredients that are recommended or used for hair loss as an example?
Yeah. So typically we will, you know, minoxidil is kind of the mainstay to help with hair loss. And, you know, that to me, that's an interesting chemical. You know, they were using it for blood pressure and then they figured out, oh, a side effect is it causes, you know, hair growth. Sometimes we see a very low dose compounded capsule of minoxidil from anywhere from 0.25 milligrams all the way up to 2.5, maybe 5 milligrams would be the max. And that being very, very effective at helping with hair loss. But most people are applying lotions or serums to their scalp of the minoxidil. One of the concerns is that we have more hair loss because we have more dihydrotestosterone. And so we'll do things like finasteride to help decrease DHT. I don't like to use that in women that are of childbearing age or around people of childbearing age because there can be cause birth defects in male offspring. But really, minoxidil is probably the most common. We'll see some biotin. Sometimes we'll see melatonin added. I'll see tretinoin added, which is typically used for acne. That's what your Retin-A is. But I think some of it is just kind of opening up the pores a little bit so that the minoxidil can penetrate better. But we see a variety of success of different formulas.
And what about for acne? What are common topical acne serums or lotions that you find, you know, pretty successful?
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't love doing antibiotics, but I would rather them apply it topically than take it orally, if that's the choice. You know, your benzoyl peroxides can be very effective. Obviously, tretinoin is good, just kind of helping fluff away. I love niacinamide. Niacinamide is a B vitamin, and it helps reduce sebum production. It helps with redness. What's my go-to add-on? Like, we have our combination, like, let's throw in some niacinamide because that's going to do nothing but be beneficial. There are different bases that can help with sebum production. We have one called Clarifying Base. It's our oily skin base. And it actually has an avocado extract in there that helps decrease sebum production. So, you know, it depends on kind of what's going on with the patient. You know, if it's an adolescent that's hormones are just raging everywhere, then we're just going to have to do the best that we can to work on their gut and clean their face and, you know, kind of calm things down. But we, you know, might be a little bit. But if it's, you know, someone that's, you know, going through hormone changes older, then we need to address those hormone changes. I always like to know the why, you know, the why of what's going on. But gut is also super important in helping what's being excreted from our face.
Right. Yeah. All right. And then I would be remiss if I didn't ask about weight loss, because obviously that's all the rage right now. So what about compounding pharmacies and weight loss?
Yes, absolutely. So I actually just gave a talk yesterday on this, with the injectables, you know, being kind of all over the place on whether people can get them, what the cost is, and all of that, and compounding not being able to do that here soon. Many of our members are doing a sublingual of the GLP-1, so sublingual semaglutide. And we actually did some studies looking at the absorption through the mucous membranes in the mouth, and one of our bases, submagna, helps with that, because it's a big molecule, so it's a high molecular weight. So to help it kind of get across the membrane, we actually, for the first time, I think, ever in the industry, we did a rat study on sublingual absorption. And we compared the oral to the injectable to the sublingual. And my first question was, how do you get a rat to hold something under its skin?
Yeah.
But I wasn't the only one to ask the question. But so they were just taking a nice little nap, and they pried their mouth open, and then they micropipetted underneath the tongue, and then they were able to measure. And it was amazing how tight the curve was on the absorption. So they all absorbed it really well, where the oral was kind of all over the board. It depended on, even though they controlled the amount of water that they gave and how long they fasted, the oral was very, very erratic. Obviously, you don't absorb the sublingual the same way you do the injectable. You're going to get more, you know, bioavailability or more through to the tissue with the injectable. But it's an option. It's an option to get it across. Now, there are other things. Oxytocin is one. Oxytocin, we think of it for stimulating labor, you know, the Pitocin, or stimulating breastfeeding. But there's some studies showing oxytocin can be beneficial in weight loss, and it controls the hedonic eating, which, funny, I was telling some colleagues, and they're like, I'm just going to say pleasure eating because that sounds weird. But so I had lunch and I'm full, but if someone walked in with a burger and fries and I smelled it, I'd be like, oh, I think I'll have some of that. That smells really good. And that would be eating for pleasure versus eating because I need to fuel my system. So, you know, there are people that eat to live and people that live to eat. And so the oxytocin helps with that pleasure eating or that hedonic eating. Naltrexone, we know that naltrexone is in one of the commercial products, Contrave. It also can kind of help a little bit with the hedonic eating and kind of create a balance. But I really think its big benefit in weight loss has to do with inflammation. So reducing inflammation, when we're less inflamed, we're less likely to hold on to weight. And it also can help with mood, which we're not feeling really good about ourselves. We're probably not going to make good choices. So yeah, those are the main things. And then sleep, making sure people are sleeping. You know, there was a study showing that people that slept less than 6 hours per night had a higher BMI. And so if that's not motivation for someone to figure out how to get to sleep longer, I don't know what is. You know, what they're eating, when they're eating, how they're eating, what is their stress like. There's, I think GLP-1s, like your semaglutide, I think is a tool in the toolkit. But I think people miss the boat when they just rely on that and don't do all the other things as well. But I did have a pharmacist tell me, he goes, for the first time, I think GLP-1s have given people hope.
Yeah.
I have hope that they can actually lose weight. And that was a good perspective for me to put that in. But just know that it's not a miracle. It's not a magic wand. And we have to do all the other things too.
Yeah, absolutely. So actually, speaking of that, like the sublingual GLP-1 option, which is very exciting, what else is on the horizon or do you see maybe is coming when it comes to compounding?
Hopefully, right now, what we're recommending our pharmacists to do is to crush the Rybelsus tablet. And so it's a 14 milligram tablet to make the sublingual. So we have limitations of the concentration that we can make because of the excipients or the other things in the tablet kind of make it too thick if we were to try to go too high. I think I've heard that there's a higher strength coming out and there's a higher strength tablet coming out, then that's going to be helpful. We'll be able to make a higher concentration of the sublingual. So that will be good. Potentially another GLP-1 that we can compound with, you know, we'll see, you know, what the availability is. But I think if we can get that higher strength semaglutide, I think in the tablet form, I think that would be really, really good. I really am a big stickler when it comes to the volume that you put underneath your tongue. So 1/4 mL, maybe 1/3 mL is about the most liquid you want to put underneath there, because anything really 1/2 mL is the absolute max. I would rather keep it to 1/4 to 1/3, but more than that, what spills over, you swallow, and the, you know, your GLP-1s are peptides, and your stomach just breaks it down. So I think it's a waste of money to put a large volume under the tongue. So I'd rather maybe do a couple of doses if we need to get a larger milligram amount in someone. But I think that's where some people aren't successful, is they throw a full milliliter underneath, they swallow half of it, they're like, it didn't work. Well, they didn't hold it as long as they should, or they ate or drank right after. You know, there's a lot of counseling that goes along with being successful.
And then in general, everything we've talked about today, is any of it covered by insurance?
Most of the insurance doesn't pay for it. There might be a few plans that do, but majority don't. But most of what we're talking about is kind of fall under what your normal, you know, non-formulary or, you know, higher copay would be. So if you got a generic and amoxicillin, that's probably very, very inexpensive. But if you got a higher tier drug that your copay is $75, you know, maybe $80, usually compounding kind of falls in that range. I was doing pain creams before pain creams were cool, you know, where I did this one formula for this one neurologist, and it was expensive. It was expensive to make the full quantity. So I would just dispense 10 grams to the patient. Like, here, I want you to make sure that this is going to work for you. And so that's always an option too, is to talk to your pharmacist and say, oh, that's a big, can I start with a smaller amount? Can I try, you know, just to make sure, because, you know, if someone is out of pain, then they're going to cut out their Starbucks, or they're going to find a way to get that into their budget because they see a benefit to it. So that's always an option too, is just chat with your pharmacist if it's like, I don't know that I can spend that all at once, but just to make sure that it works.
And one of the things that I find is that a lot of, and this is through no fault of their own, but a lot of conventional practitioners, maybe somebody listening is like, oh, my OBGYN would never, they have no idea about compounding pharmacies. How would you find a practitioner who is savvy, who is open to this? If you're listening, thinking, oh my gosh, having compounded thyroid is probably what I need, or a compounded pain cream, we didn't even talk about that, or something for my acne, my hair loss, like those sound exactly what I would love to discuss. How do you find somebody?
Yeah. So I had and when I had my compounding only pharmacy, I had a list of providers that I worked with. And some were a little more conventional than others, but they knew that if the patient said, hey, Sarah sent me to see you, They knew which direction that they were going to go because that's why the patient was there. So talk to your local compounding pharmacy and ask. Now, I always wanted to work with the provider that the patient had. You know, you already have this relationship with a provider. And so I would do everything I could to help educate that provider for that patient. But sometimes it's a closed door. And sometimes they're like, nope, not going to do it. If it doesn't come from the regular pharmacy, not going to prescribe it. And so then you find a prescriber that will. And so your compounding pharmacist, they know who is prescribing the different therapies.
And I do want to just reiterate, it's very common for a compounding pharmacy to get phone calls to say, hi, I'm looking for hormones. I'm looking for this. I'm looking for that. Who do you recommend? Or do you have a list? Or who in the area does this? Again, I'm in the Portland, Oregon area, but we have several compounding pharmacies. And I was always, I mean, I compounded, but I had a number of patients find me because they would say, I called the pharmacy. I didn't, you know, you were on the list and you took my insurance or you were available. And so here I am, help me out. And I don't know that that's necessarily common. Most people don't call their conventional pharmacist. Nobody calls CVS or Costco or Kroger, or whoever you use, and says, you know, find me a doctor. But it is quite common to be calling up your compounding pharmacy to say, I'm in the area, need help.
Right. And as a compounder, like, you see these prescribing habits, you see the patients coming in, you hear what they are saying about their providers. So they really have their ear to the ground on the providers. And then if they know, you know, once they get to know you, then they're like, oh, you would be a good fit with this provider or that provider. But yeah, use them as a resource.
So wonderful. When I had a brick and mortar clinic back in the day, I mean, I would just call the compounding pharmacy and first name basis, you know, I was like, hey, it's Carrie. And they were like, oh, hey, Dr. Carrie, nothing good. And that's just how wonderful, you know, even as practitioners, when you use compounding pharmacies, you develop such a relationship with them. And even I and all my colleagues who use them will call to, quote unquote, pick their brain. I have a patient. This is what's going on. I'm super stumped. What have you seen? You know, what do you think might help? And obviously the practitioner, I would have final say, but sometimes I wouldn't know what to do. I wouldn't know what direction. Like, oh my gosh, they reacted to this cream. Like, what else do you got? And it was so helpful because your education is so expansive in that world. Plus you have all the experience of all the orders you fill all day long that I could just call and say, I need help. I don't know what to do.
And, you know, and that's where the patient really benefits when you have that team, you know, because you as a practitioner, you're going to diagnose and you're going to know what's going on with the body. We know the drugs. We know, you know, the dosage forms and we know other ins and outs, that it just makes such a great team. And the patient being a big part of that and being, you know, having a voice and, you know, having that triad relationship, all three of us is crucial for good patient care.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, as we wrap up, are there any final words around compounding pharmacies? Anything I didn't ask you that you want to make really clear for everyone listening?
Yeah, just know that, you know, one size doesn't fit all. And if you're struggling with your medication, there could be an option for you outside of what has been given to you conventionally. And then for women, please don't be told that you're crazy. Please get your hormones checked if you think things just aren't right. Keep asking the questions until you get the answer that feels right in your gut, because that's just been my passion, is helping women, because I think too many are just brushed aside and told that they're crazy. And I've seen, you know, families destroyed because of it. It's so important for you to get your hormones checked. So please, please do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Sarah, it's been wonderful. And for all our practitioners, maybe even pharmacists who are listening, I have worked with Sarah multiple times with PCCA. So can you let practitioners listening know, maybe they want to learn more about compounding, they want to come to your conferences and get more education, how would they do that to learn? Because I will say PCCA, while it obviously is for supporting pharmacists, as a non-pharmacist, I have learned a ton going to their conferences and getting their emails and what have you. So where can people find out more?
Yeah, so at PCCARX.com. And then we're on all social media. We put out all sorts of reels and everything on all the social media, but we do put on two big HRT events per year. The one Dr. Jones and I were at, where it was in Vegas, but we have another one coming up in July, which will be virtual. And we're always looking for new speakers to bring new ideas. Our big event is international, is just for pharmacists, but any of the other education events, we put on webinars. Like, I think there's a webinar going on right now about semaglutide and the MACVA dosing. So there's lots of education. Our team puts on a lot of education. So PCCARX.com.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for being on the Root Cause Medicine podcast. This has been so helpful and so enlightening. And I know for a fact that this is going to help a lot of people who have been really struggling and not really sure where to turn next when it came to their medication or hormones.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode.
We have one quick favor to ask you before you go.
If you love today's conversation, would you mind leaving us a 5-star review on whatever podcast platform you're listening on right now?
Our whole goal is education. So positive reviews are actually the number one thing that help new people discover the show.
You're amazing, and we appreciate it so much.
We'll catch you next time on the Root Cause Medicine Podcast.